All right, tonight I'd like to pick up where we left off in the first book of Kings. We left off in chapter 20. And though for those of you who weren't here last week when we went through chapter 19, just a long story short, we've gotten to the portion of Scripture now where we're dealing with Elijah the Tishbite, and he was the one who actually stood up against 450 prophets of Baal single-handedly with that challenge up there on Mount Carmel. And he's the one that basically called fire down from heaven to consume the sacrifice, and then the people turned their loyalty back to God, and Elijah had these false prophets killed or executed because of their misleading people, leading people astray as far as their spiritual commitment to God. And anyway, he takes off running from Ahab's wife Jezebel, and he goes down all the way down to Mount Horeb, and God speaks to him down there and then gives him more instructions. So he comes back up to fulfill a number of the things that are the commissions that God has told him to carry out. Now we pick up in this chapter 20, and this is an episode that doesn't involve Elijah, but it's a time when Ahab, when he's ruling as king, the Syrians are basically picking a fight with him. And here's a couple of things to keep in mind. When we read in chapter 19, God gave Elijah specific instructions. He said that if you look on that verse 15 of chapter 19, God said to Elijah, he says, "Go, return your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you have arrived, you shall anoint Hazael, the king over Syria." So Elijah was supposed to do this because this king Ben-Hadad, whom we're going to read about tonight, he's king of Syria, and you know he's a wicked, evil man, and God's going to have him done away with. So God wants this new king, Hazael, to take his place. So I just say that in passing because it might be a little confusing if you don't put the two and two together with these two chapters. Beginning at verse 1 of chapter 20, it says, "Now Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, gathered all of his armies, and there were 32 kings with him, and horses and chariots, and he went up and besieged Samaria and fought against it. Then he sent messengers to the city to Ahab, the king of Israel, and said to him, 'Thus says Ben-Hadad, your silver and your gold are mine. Your most beautiful wives and children are also mine.' And the king of Israel answered and said, 'It is according to your word, my lord, O king. I am yours and all that I have.' Then the messengers returned and said, 'Thus says Ben-Hadad, surely I sent to you, saying, you shall give me your silver and your gold and your wives and your children. But about this time tomorrow, I will send my servants to you, then they will search out your house and the houses of your servants, and it shall come about whatever is desirable in your eyes, they will take in their hand and carry away.' Then the king of Israel called all the elders of the land and said, 'Please observe and see how this man is looking for trouble. For he sent to me for my wives and my children and my silver and my gold, and I did not refuse him.' And all the elders of all the people said to him, 'Do not listen or consent.' So he said to the messengers of Ben-Hadad, 'Tell my lord the king all that you sent for to your servant at the first I will do, but this thing I cannot do.' And the messengers departed and brought him word again. And Ben-Hadad sent to him and said, 'May the gods do so to me and more so, if the dust of Samaria shall suffice for handfuls for all the people who follow me.' Then the king of Israel answered and said, 'Tell him, let not him who girds on his armor boast like him who takes it off.' And it came about when Ben-Hadad heard this message, as he was drinking with his kings in the temporary shelters, that he said to his servants, 'Station yourselves.' So they stationed themselves against the city." Now, before we go further, I just want to say a couple things in passing. Okay, here's this king Ben-Hadad. He's from Syria. If you look on my map there, it's right up here. All right, and he's the king of Damascus, and he's picking a fight with Ahab, who's king of Samaria. So he's going to come down here, and he gives him this ultimatum. He says, "Look, your gold is mine, your silver is mine, your wives are mine, and your children are mine." And what does Ahab do? Ahab is a man, to me, he's pretty much of a man who's very wishy-washy. He doesn't seem to have much of a backbone. But he says, "Okay, I'll do it." In other words, in order to save his little hiney, he just figures, "Okay, you can have my wives and my kids and my gold and my silver." And he figures that would appease Ben-Hadad. But what does Ben-Hadad do? As soon as he gets that message, now he sends another message back to Ahab and says, "Well, I've changed my mind. Not only am I going to take your wives and your children and your gold and your silver, but my servants or my men or my army is going to go into your palace, and we're going to take whatever we want." Now, once Ahab hears that, then he figures, "Hey, man, there's going to be no end to this." And so he calls the elders, he calls some counselors together and asks them what they should do. And said, "Well, don't give him anything now." But see, I think it's kind of instructive. What happens when people try to appease evil? If we're dealing with evil, forces of evil, especially if we're dealing with the devil, we can't appease the devil. You can't appease evil. You can't just say, okay, thus far, no further. I'm just going to give in this much. I'm just going to compromise this much. Because it's never going to stop there. It just doesn't. Even when Ahab was willing to give up his wives and his kids, I mean, you know, it wasn't going to stop there. So then he finally, I guess, sees the light, and now he determines, well, I'm going to just have to dig my heels in and refuse this man. Now, verse 13, it says, Now behold, the prophet approached Ahab, the king of Israel, and said, Thus saith the Lord, Have you seen all this great multitude? Behold, I will deliver them into your hand today, and you shall know that I am the Lord. Now, this prophet here, I don't believe it's Elijah, because it probably would have said Elijah here, but it was another prophet that went to Ahab. Now, keep something in mind. Ahab, he's a wicked king. He's one of the worst kings, and he's married that notoriously wicked woman named Jezebel. And the two of them, I think, they ended up having almost like a chemical reaction where they became almost a third personality, where evil just personified itself. But nevertheless, in spite of Ahab's wickedness, God's going to deal with this wicked Ben-Hadad first, because he just basically had sent this prophet to Ahab and said, hey man, I'm going to turn around and do this guy in because of his wickedness. You see, sometimes wickedness can rear its ugly head for years and years and decades and on end. But in the end, when the cup of iniquity begins to overflow, then judgment comes. And for this Ben-Hadad, this king of Syria, I mean, his time is about up. So look what God says to him, because it's pretty significant. Because this guy's a blasphemer. He's a man who just has no fear of God. He just determined that he's going to continually attack God's people. When I read about like people like Ben-Hadad, you know, I know this may seem like a mental leap or a real stretch, but I just see so many people like that today, as far as like people like in the ACLU or people who are always at war with God or odds with God, these academic eggheads in our colleges who are called forever dumbing people down with this notion that if you believe in God, you're superstitious, you're ignorant, you're foolish, this type of thing. Well, there comes a time when God says, okay, enough's enough. And look at that verse 13. And behold, a prophet approached Ahab, king of Israel, and said, Thus saith the Lord, have you seen all this great multitude? Now, he's talking about the Syrian army that's against him. They were such a formidable army, nobody could deal with them. But God's not restrained by numbers. He just says, hey, their time's up. He says, have you seen this great multitude? Behold, I will deliver them into your hand today, and you shall know that I am the Lord. In other words, there's going to be no doubt, because the odds are so stacked against you, you're going to know that God helped you in this. And in verse 14 it says, And Ahab said, By whom? So he said, Thus saith the Lord, by the young men of the rulers of the provinces. Then he said, Who shall begin the battle? And he answered, You. Then he mustered the young men of the rulers of the provinces, and there was 232. And after them he mustered all the people, and even all the sons of Israel, 7,000. Now what he's got here is he's got 7,232 men against an army you can't count. So it's, the odds are really stacked against him. But in verse 16 it says, And then they went out at noon, while Ben-Hadad was drinking himself drunk in the temporary shelters with the 32 kings who had helped him. So he's with 32 other kings, and they're all accomplices, and they're all in alliance here to destroy the northern tribes of Israel, or the northern capital of Israel. And the guy's, look at the guy, he's drinking himself drunk. This gives you a little indication about his character. I mean, this guy who says, I don't know, just completely indulged in his flesh, and there's no satisfying him as far as his lust for money, fame, prestige, popularity, whatever. In verse 17 says, And the young men of the rulers of the provinces went out first, and Ben-Hadad sent out, and they told him, saying, Men have come out from Samaria. Then he said, If they have come out for peace, take them alive, or if they have come out for war, take them alive. And the reason I think he wants them taken alive is he wants to torture them. So in verse 19 he says, So these went out from the city, and the young men of the rulers of the provinces, and the army which followed them, and they killed each his man, and the Syrians fled, and Israel pursued them, and Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, escaped on a horse with horsemen. And the king of Israel went out and struck the horses and the chariots, and killed the Syrians with a great slaughter. Then the prophet came near to the king of Israel and said to him, Go strengthen yourself and observe and see what you have to do, for at the turn of the year, the king of Syria will come up against you. Now look what happens. God gives him a great victory. He's far outnumbered here, but God gives him a great victory, not because God is in Ahab's camp, so to speak, but it's just time for Ben-Hadad to be judged. And God says, I'm going to use Ahab, I'm going to use Israel to judge him. And what happens now? Ben-Hadad is soundly defeated, but what does this prophet say to Ahab? He says this in verse 22, "Then the prophet came near to the king of Israel and said to him, 'Go strengthen yourself and observe and see what you have to do, for at the turn of the year the king of Syria will come up against you.'" In other words, he's saying, hey, this isn't over. He's going to come back. And isn't that the way the devil is? He is absolutely relentless. I mean, every time you may have a victory, you can never sit back and take your ease and think, well, I finally have arrived and there's going to be no more troubles in the future. What happened with Jesus? Remember when the devil was out there after Jesus had fasted for 40 days, 40 nights, and then the devil tempted him, challenged him to turn the stones into loaves of bread, and he wouldn't do that. And then he said he'd give him all the kingdoms of the earth if he just bowed down to him and worship him, and he wouldn't do that. And then he said, if you throw yourself off this pinnacle, because it's written that God will give his angels charge over you, and Jesus didn't do that. He refuted him each time with scripture. And then it says the devil left him for a season, for a short season. In other words, the devil figured, okay, I lost this round, but I haven't lost the war yet. He's a diehard. He's perpetual motion. He's going to continue to keep coming back relentlessly because he's not going to be defeated as far as he's concerned. And so you see a situation here, again, even if we are victorious, let's say, against some of the evil that's perpetrating itself upon our country today, if we're victorious at the polls or if we're victorious in the courts, hey, it doesn't stop there. It doesn't stop there at all, does it? Pick your poison. I don't care what sin it is. It'll just continue to encroach upon us unless we really take a stand and push it back. So you can rest assured that simply because we may have one spiritual victory, that doesn't mean it's the end of it, because this guy, Ben-Hadad, is going to come back. Now look at verse 23. "Now the servants of the king of Syria said to him, 'Their gods are gods of the mountains, therefore they were stronger than we. But rather let us fight against them in the plain, and surely we shall be stronger than they. And do this thing, remove the kings, each from his place, and put captains in their place.'" In other words, what he's saying there is this. His servants are telling him, okay, well, you got defeated, you got your rear end kicked there, and the reason you did is because Israel's gods are the gods of the mountains, but our gods are the gods of the plains. So let's challenge them to a battle, to a war down there in the plains. And he says, get rid of the kings and put generals, or basically captains, in their place. In other words, this was kind of like sound advice. Put battle-hardened, experienced men leading your armies, instead of these drunken kings. You know what I'm saying? That's basically what he's saying. And then he figures, well, we can't lose them, because look at that verse 24. "And do this thing, remove the kings, each from his place, and put captains in their place, and muster an army like the army that you have lost, a horse for horse, a chariot for chariot. Then we will fight against them in the plain, and surely we shall be stronger than they." And he listened to their voice and did so. And it came about at the turn of the year that Ben-Hadad mustered the Syrians and went up to Aphek to fight against Israel. Now, I don't know if you can see it on the map, but here's Aphek right here. Here's Damascus here. He's coming down to Aphek there. This is where they're going to fight. It's almost really close to the Sea of Galilee there, where they're going to have this confrontation. And it says here, verse 27, "And the sons of Israel were mustered and bore provisions and went to meet them. And the sons of Israel camped before them like two little flocks of goats, but the Syrians filled the country. Then a man of God came near and spoke to the king of Israel and said, 'Thus saith the Lord, behold, the Syrians have said, the Lord is a God of the mountains, but he is not a God of the valleys. Therefore, I will give all of this great multitude into your hands, and you shall know that I am the Lord.'" In other words, this is God's battle, because these people are so arrogant. They say, well, their gods are stronger in the mountains than ours, so we'll fight them down here in the valley. And God's just showing them, hey, I'm God. There is no other God. I'm the God of the mountains and the valleys and the plains and the hills and everything else. And he's in verse 29, it says, "So they camped one over against the other 7 days, and it came about on the seventh day that the battle was joined, and the sons of Israel killed of the Syrians 100,000 foot soldiers in one day. But the rest fled to Aphek into the city, and the wall fell on 27,000 who were left, and Ben-Hadad fled and came into the city into an inner chamber." Look what happened here. I mean, when the battle gets started here, I guess they faced off each other for 7 days, and on the seventh day, they went at it. They killed 100,000 men of the Syrians, and then Ben-Hadad starts to, a lot of the army starts to flee into the city, and God just brings down a wall on him, kills 27,000 of them. And now Ben-Hadad is really running for his life now, because he says in verse 31, it says, "And his servant said to him, Behold, now we have heard that the king of the house of Israel is a merciful king. Please let us put sackcloth on our loins and ropes on our heads and go out to the king of Israel. Perhaps he will save your life." So they girded the sackcloth on their loins and put ropes on their heads. And they came to the king of Israel and said, "Your servant Ben-Hadad says, Please let me live." And he said, "Is he still alive? He is my brother." Now the men took this as an omen, and quickly catching his words, said, "Your brother Ben-Hadad." Then he said, "Go bring him." Then Ben-Hadad came out to him, and he took him up into the chariot. And Ben-Hadad said to him, "The cities which my father took from your father I will restore, and you shall make streets for yourself in Damascus, as my father made in Samaria." Ahab said, "And I will let you go with this covenant." So he made a covenant with him and let him go. Now, look what happens here. It's a situation where Ben-Hadad's held up in a home in some kind of fortress when he's in this city, and he realizes he's dead meat. He's surrounded, and he's just had it. But some of his servants say, "Hey, listen, I heard of the kings of Israel. They're merciful kings. Let's just go out before them in sackcloth and ashes and whatever and beg for our life." So what Ben-Hadad does is he sends out his servants, and they got sackcloth on, they got ropes around their head. I guess it's a sign of mourning or distress or self-inflicted punishment, you know, that they deserved or whatever. And then they said, "Your servant Ben-Hadad is pleading for his life." And then Ahab turns around and says, "Oh, he's my brother." And of course, this Ben-Hadad servants pick right up on this. Says, "Oh yeah, he's your brother. He, you know, you guys are brothers." You see, this Ahab, he didn't have any discernment. He didn't realize, you know what you're dealing with here? You're dealing with a very, very wicked, evil man. And he needs to be executed and put an end to this, his wickedness. But instead, he appeases him, and he even makes a covenant with him. Brings him up his chariot, and it says here, he made a covenant with him and let him go. In other words, he's saying what Ben-Hadad said was, "Hey, you can have access to Damascus, just like my father had access to Samaria." It's like they're talking like old lost friends, and they're making this covenant with one another, and he's making a covenant with evil here. So it says in verse 35, "Now a certain man of the sons of the prophets said to another, By the word of the Lord, please strike me. But the man refused to strike him. Then he said to them, Because you have not listened to the voice of the Lord, behold, as soon as you have departed from me, a lion will kill you. And as soon as he departed from him, a lion found him and killed him." Now this is kind of interesting, because God wants to make a point to Ahab in a very, very profound way. So one of the prophets of God, he tells his prophet, "Tell that other prophet over there to wound you, you know, to strike you with the sword and wound you." The other prophet wouldn't do it. So he says, "Because you didn't obey the voice of the Lord, you're going to get killed by a lion." Now that's pretty interesting, isn't it? Because sometimes God will tell us to do something that may seem very, very distasteful, but we have to be obedient. You would think, well, you know, the guy is pretty squeamish. He doesn't want to do this. But here's the thing. He says, God said to do it, but he refused to do it because he couldn't find the nerve to do it. He said, "Well, I don't want to hurt you." And he said, "Well, God told you to do it." All right? God wants to use this prophet as kind of a living testimony, a pantomime, a prophecy in regards to Ahab. And because that prophet wouldn't obey the voice of the Lord, then he incurs his judgment. And now he says in that verse 37, "Then he," that's the prophet we're talking about, "then he found another man and said, Please strike me. And the man struck him, wounding him. So the prophet departed and waited for the king by the way and disguised himself with a bandage over his eyes. And as the king passed by, he cried to the king and said, Your servant went out into the midst of the battle, and behold, a man turned aside and brought a man to me and said, Guard this man. If for any reason he is missing, then your life shall be for his, or else you shall pay me a talent of silver," or basically around $2,000. "And while your servant was busy here and there, he was gone. And the king said to him, So shall your judgment be. You yourself have decided it. Then he hastily took off the bandage away from his eyes, and the king of Israel recognized that he was one of the prophets, and he said to him, Thus saith the Lord, because you have let go out of your hand the man whom I devoted to destruction, therefore your life shall go for his life, and your people for his people. So the king of Israel went to his house sullen and vexed, and came to Samaria." Now, here's the situation. That prophet went up to him, and he basically disguised himself. In other words, it was like when he asked a guy to wound him. I'm getting this impression. He just wounded him, maybe cut him in the face or something. He didn't do it. It was just kind of a surface wound where it wasn't really deep, but it was enough to have a bandage over his head to look like he had been bleeding. And so when the king went by, he just called out to the king, and basically he tells him this story. He says, hey, during the middle of this battle, I got this prisoner. I was supposed to be watching this prisoner, but in the heat of the battle, I was trying to do these other things, and the guy escaped. And he was trying to get the king to commute his punishment, because he figured, like, I have a justified reason. You know, I was supposed to watch this guy, but he got away because I was so busy in the battle. And the king said, hey, you brought this punishment upon yourself. And so, in a sense, once he pronounced that judgment upon this prophet, not knowing he was a prophet, then the prophet took off his bandage and he recognized him as a prophet. Now, see, that's why he did this. He did not want Ahab to see him. In other words, he wanted to disguise himself so that Ahab would not recognize him. Why do you think he wanted to do that?
So we'll get the true Ahab. Ahab won't be putting on a show.
Right, right. In other words, if Ahab recognized him as one of the prophets, and then the prophet said this, then Ahab probably would have given a totally different answer. But Ahab just looks at him as just a, you know, kind of a flunky out there who screwed up. So he pronounces judgment upon him. He said, hey, your judgment's on your own head. And then the prophet takes off his bandage. And he says, hey man, you just pronounced judgment on yourself because God had devoted this man, this wicked, evil king, to destruction. But since you let him go, you're going to die in his place. And then instead of you being victorious over his people, their people are going to be victorious over you. So this judgment came back on him. This is what, again, what happens when you try to appease evil? It's always going to get you in the end. So what happens? Ahab goes back home and he's all ticked off and he's sullen. He's frustrated. But I think there's a dark warning here for us, right? I mean, to me, you can read this chapter 20 in 1 Kings and feel like, well, this is just a lot of boring, dry information or useless information or just worthless history as far as we're concerned. But, you know, it's God's Word, and it's here for our instruction. And I'm looking around us today, and I am seeing so much compromising going on in the church today in the name of tolerance, in the name of quote-unquote love, in the name of all these other things, right? That people can be so blind when it comes to their own evil, their own sin, but they're so ready to pronounce judgment on other people's sins. Just like, this is why this prophet did that. Ahab immediately pronounced judgment upon him, saying, hey, well, you know, you got to pay. I'm not going to commute your sentence here. And when he did that, what did he do? He sealed his own judgment. This is what Paul tells us in Romans, when he's talking about how people who give their hearty approval to the sins of other people, and yet at the same time condemn others for what they conceive to be an injustice or a wrong or an evil, Paul says it comes right back on their head and they condemn themselves. Anyway, does anybody have anything to add or share to this chapter 20? Because I'd like to just go through this chapter 21. It's easy reading, and Elijah the Tishbite comes back into view. But it says in verse 1 of chapter 21, it says, now it came about after these things that Naboth the Jezreelite had a vineyard which was in Jezreel beside the palace of Ahab the king of Samaria. And Ahab spoke to Naboth, saying, give me your vineyard that I may have it for a vegetable garden, because it is close beside my house, and I will give you a better vineyard than it in its place, if you like. And I will give you the price of it in money. But Naboth said to Ahab, the Lord forbid me that I should give you the inheritance of my fathers. So Ahab came into his house, sullen and vexed because of the word which Naboth the Jezreelite had spoke to him. For he said, I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers. And he laid down on his bed and turned away his face and ate no food. Now get a glimpse of this guy. This guy is something else, okay? He's basically throwing a tantrum. He looks over at his neighbor's yard, and he sees Naboth's vineyard, rather. And it's really close to his palace. And he thought, man, that's a beautiful vineyard, man. That would be a real asset to the rest of my possessions. So he just goes out there and makes an offer to Naboth, say, hey, I'll buy this field from you, or I'll even trade you if you give me this field. And Naboth didn't want to do it because this is his inheritance. It's been in his family generation after generation after generation, and he's not going to part with it. So Ahab, he goes home and he's pouting. I mean, he's throwing a tantrum. He goes up into his room, closes the door, turns his face against the wall. He's not going to eat. I mean, does that show a very immature character? It certainly does to me. Then it says here in that verse 5, he says, "But Jezebel, his wife, came to him and said to him, 'How is it that your spirit is so sullen and you are not eating food?' So he said to her, 'Because I spoke to Naboth the Jezreelite and said to him, "Give me your vineyard for money, or else, if it pleases you, I will give you a vineyard in his place." But he said, 'I will not give you my vineyard.' So Jezebel, his wife, said to him, 'Do you now reign over Israel? Arise, eat bread, and let your heart be joyful, and I will give you the vineyard Naboth the Jezreelite.' So she wrote letters in Ahab's name and sealed them with his seal and sent letters to the elders and to the nobles who were living with Naboth in the city. Now she wrote in the letter saying, 'Proclaim a fast and seek Naboth at the head of the people, and seek two worthless men before him, and let them testify against him, saying, "You curse God and the king." Let them take him out and stone him to death.' So the men of the city, the elders and the nobles who lived in the city, did as Jezebel had sent word to them, just as it is was written in the letters which she had sent to them. They proclaimed a fast and seated Naboth at the head of the people. Then two of the worthless men came in and sat before him, and the worthless men testified against him, even against Naboth, before the people, saying, 'Naboth cursed God and the king.' So they took him outside the city and stoned him to death with stones. Then they sent word to Jezebel, saying, 'Naboth has been stoned and is dead.' And it came about when Jezebel had heard that Naboth had been stoned and was dead, that Jezebel said to Ahab, 'Arise and take possession of the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite, which he refused to give you for money. For Naboth is not alive, but dead.' And it came about when Ahab heard that Naboth was dead, that Ahab arose to go down to the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite to take possession of it. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, 'Arise, go down to meet Ahab the king of Israel, who is in Samaria. Behold, he is in the vineyard of Naboth, where he has gone down to take possession of it. And you shall speak to him, saying, "Thus saith the Lord, have you murdered and also taken possession?" And you shall speak to him, saying, "Thus saith the Lord, in the place where the dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, the dogs will lick up your blood, even yours." And Ahab said to Elijah, "Have you found me, my enemy?" And he answered, "I have found you, because you have sold yourself to do evil in the sight of the Lord. Behold, I will bring evil upon you, and will utterly sweep you away, and will cut off from Ahab every male, both bond and free, in Israel, and I will make your house like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha, the son of Ahijah, because of the provocations with which you have provoked me to anger, and because you have made Israel sin. And of Jezebel also has the Lord spoken, saying, "The dog shall eat Jezebel in the district of Jezreel, and the one belonging to Ahab who dies in the city, the dog shall eat, and the one who dies in the field, the birds of the heaven shall eat. Surely there was no one like Ahab who sold himself to do evil in the sight of the Lord, because Jezebel, his wife, incited him. And he acted very abominably in following the idols, according to all that the Amorites had done, whom the Lord had cast out before the sons of Israel." And it came about when Ahab heard these words that he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and fasted, and he laid in sackcloth and went about despondently. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, "Do you see how Ahab has humbled himself before me? Because he has humbled himself before me, I will not bring the evil in his days, but I will bring the evil upon his house in his son's days." Now, the reason I finished reading that whole 29 verses, because I didn't want to break up this theme. Here's Ahab. He's the king of Israel. He's got two palaces. We know he's got one in Samaria, and I think it was referred to as the Palace of Ivory. The guy's a wealthy guy. He's got a palace down there in Jezreel. He's got all this fame, all this popularity, all this money, all this prestige, and he's not happy. He sees this other guy's vineyard and he says, "God, I gotta have that." And then he just figures he's gonna get it like he gets everything else. He's gonna go over there and buy it. Naboth won't budge. He won't sell it. He says, "This is my inheritance from the Lord. I'm keeping it." So Ahab just has a fit. He has a tantrum. He goes up and he's all sullen and pouting in his room. Look at his wife Jezebel. She comes in there and wants to know what the problem is. He tells her and she says, "Hey man, are you king of Israel or not, man? I'll take care of this dude. Don't worry about it. I'll take care of him." So what does she do? Look at how wicked this woman is. She writes all these different letters to these elders in the city of Naboth, and she puts on this, they called it a fast, but what I think it was a religious feast. And they were going to have Naboth sit there as kind of like a guest of honor. And then it says, "worthless fellows." Now, it said that two or three times about worthless fellows. The Bible makes it abundantly clear that there are worthless people. Now, granted, everybody's created in the image and likeness of God. They have eternal value. But when he's talking about being worthless, he's talking about their character as being worthless in God's eyes. Because that's what God looks at. When he looks into a person's soul, I mean, what does he see? What kind of character does he see? Well, you know, these people were just primed with their character to do this evil deed, to go along with it. I'm sure they got money under the table from Jezebel. So what did they do? They stood up and they lied about Naboth. They made these accusations against him, saying that he cursed God and a king. And if you go back to, I think it's the 17th chapter or 20th chapter of Leviticus, God gives specific instructions saying that anybody who blasphemes God or curses God shall be stoned to death. So they make up this lie, and he's executed right there. And then what happens? God sends Elijah to him, Elijah to Ahab. Now, Ahab, I get the impression that he probably suspected his wife doing some of these shenanigans, but it doesn't sound like he was really involved in it. You see, you get these two people here, it's like there's a chemistry between them. Both of them are worthless as far as their characters are concerned, but then you put the two of them together, and then they really become a volatile mix. You ever see that with people? A lot of people in prison today are there because they hung around the wrong crowd or with the wrong person at the wrong time. You know, something they would never have done on their own. When they get together with another person who's got a real flawed character, then they almost become a third personality where the wickedness really begins to come out of it. You know what I'm talking about? I mean, I've seen it time and again. And the Bible does say, hey, bad company will corrupt good morals. And so these two are just two bad eggs to get together, and they really make a stink together. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Because look at this woman. Isn't she cold and callous and calculating and evil? Because she, you know, has this man murdered. And then she says to her husband, hey, go get the vineyard. It's yours now. Naboth's dead. So he goes down there. He's checking it all out, saying, oh, man, this is great. This is mine now. Elijah goes over there and says, he just gets in his face. He says, you've sold yourself out totally to do evil. And because you've done this, he pronounces a curse upon them. Look at that verse 19. And you shall speak to him, saying, thus saith the Lord, have you murdered and also taken possession? You shall speak to him, saying, thus saith the Lord, in the place where the dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, the dogs shall lick up your blood, even yours. Now we're going to read when we get into 2 Kings the fulfillment of this. Because Naboth was killed in his own vineyard, stoned to death. And God says, where you killed this man, will you shed his blood? Your blood is going to be shed right there. And then he pronounces a judgment upon his wife, or Jezebel, because he said that verse 23, and of Jezebel also has the Lord spoken, saying, the dog shall eat Jezebel in the district of Jezreel. And, of course, that was her end. When we're going to get into 2 Kings, we're going to read about her destruction because of her evil and her wickedness. And her dogs will devour everything but the palms of her hands and her feet. Because this woman was so evil as far as her feet running to do wickedness and her hands performing such evil that not even the dogs could eat her hands or her palms of her feet. All right, but this is quite a judgment. So what happens when God pronounces his judgment against Ahab? Then Ahab, he becomes so bummed out, he starts humbling himself before God, wearing sackcloth and ashes, and God's taken back by this. And he tells Elijah, he says, you see this guy? He's humbled himself before me. And because he's humbled himself before me, I'm not going to destroy his whole household while he's still alive. I'll do it after he's dead. All right, so you see almost God, even though this guy was so wicked, he humbled himself, and he really was sincere in his humbling himself. God relented to some of the punishment that he was going to bring upon him. And I think that says a lot in terms of God's compassion, his mercy, his forgiveness. But what does he look for? Like David said, he looks for a broken, contrite spirit. But one last thing before we close on this chapter here is that look at everything that Ahab had. Wives and children, he had gold, he had silver, he had riches, he had fame, he had two palaces. One was called the Ivory Palace, and it wasn't enough. And he became discontent. Now you tell me, go back to the very first sin that was committed by our first parents. Look at that situation. You got a situation there where the devil says to Eve, the very first word he uses is indeed. Indeed. Did God say you shouldn't eat of the fruit of this tree? All right? And that word indeed, you know, that's the very first word that Satan spoke to mankind. That word basically means, in a sarcastic sense, it means you got to be kidding. This was the very first word that the devil spoke to mankind. Basically saying, you got to be kidding. If you believe God, I got a bridge I can sell you, right? This woman She didn't have a fallen nature. She had everything imaginable. Here, her and her husband are living in this perfect world, this perfect garden. You know, they're under perfect happiness. They don't have any problems with each other. I mean, it's not like men are from Mars and women are from Venus. It's not that they can't communicate. I mean, they have an ideal marriage. They walk in the cool of the day with the Lord. Whenever my mind tries to conjure up what heaven must be like or utopia on earth, that was it. In my mind, that's it. Where you got a situation where you've got just a loving bond as a husband and wife, and there's no conflict there. You don't have to worry about sickness or disease or hunger or thirst or anything. Everything's at your fingertips. And yet, with one word, the devil was able to incite discontent in this woman, saying, did God say you shouldn't eat of this fruit? That the day that we eat of it, the woman said, God said we're going to die. And the devil said, hey, God's flim-flamming you, man. He's jerking you around. You're not going to die. He says, God knows that the day you eat that fruit, you're going to become like God. Your eyes going to be opened. You'll know good from evil, right? So what happened? He managed to stir up within that woman a sense of discontent. And that's where it all began. Centuries later, thousands of years later, you got this Ahab, and you see he's got virtually everything as king, and yet he's discontent. Because of one little thing that he doesn't have. But what does Paul tell us in the New Testament? He says, I have learned the secret of being content, whether I have little or whether I have much, whether I'm hungry or whether I'm thirsty. You know, whatever the situation, he learned the secret. And I think that that's pretty significant because he uses the word, it's a learned secret. In other words, it doesn't come by osmosis. It doesn't come by being struck by lightning and all of a sudden we understand what it means to be content. It means to be content is something we have to work at. But what does it take to really be a contented person?
Be thankful for what you have.
There it is. If we can learn to be grateful for what God has given us in life, we will cultivate what it means to be content. Because I'm telling you, there's so much out there to be discontented about. And the devil's always there to try to plant that seed of discontent in our hearts. I will never see a person, well, at least of my knowledge, you know, that I don't see a person who's handicapped, either physically, mentally, emotionally, in wheelchairs, or the guy today, I've known him for years. The poor guy, physically, he's just a mess. He walks with a limp, he's got braces on, and he's just, you see this poor guy's life, and I've known him for 20-something years. I stop and I just thank God for my health, and I thank God for my eyesight. I thank God for the health of my children. I thank God, you know what I'm saying? Because it's like, hey, we got so much to be thankful for, but the devil is always there trying to just throw in that curveball, saying, well, hey, man, you're not going to be happy unless you get this, unless you get rid of that, unless this happens, or that happens. And, you know, I have to always look, stop and I say, you know what? Is there anything that you would not be willing to give up for $1 million? Would you be willing to give up your eyesight for $1 million? Or your hearing? Or the use of your arms or your legs? What wouldn't you give up for $1 million? If you stop and think about it, there's a multitude of things I would not give up for $1 million, for $1 billion, for $1 trillion. You can't put a price tag on it. And you almost have to look at life in that perspective. Just say, how many things? And all you need is one thing that you're not willing to give up for $1 million. And guess what? You're a millionaire. But we're millionaires many times over if we kind of take a look at life from a different perspective. And I think that helps to do what? It helps us to learn the secret of being content. Because the devil's always there to stir up this discontent. And look what happened to this guy. He wasn't happy with everything he had. He got discontented and, you know, couldn't have what he wanted. But what does the Bible say about the 9th and the 10th commandment? It says, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's goods, right? Well, this is what he did. He coveted his goods. He lusted after his goods. And what does James say? He says that when lust is conceived, it brings forth sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. This guy lusted after a field that wasn't his. I like the way James words it. He says, when lust is conceived. In other words, is there such a thing as being almost pregnant or partially pregnant? You know, there's no such thing. So when you say, when lust is conceived, it brings forth sin. And when sin is accomplished, when it finally has the end results of sin, it brings forth death. And this is what we're going to see with Ahab. But I just wanted to throw that out before we close as far as what it takes to be content. Because it is really tough to be content today. It is. because the devil's got 100,000 different sirens beckoning for our attention. And look at Hollywood. Look at Madison Avenue. Look at the entertainment industry. Just go down to the mall. And what do you see down there? You see a concentration of, you know, the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, the pride of life. I mean, there's nothing wrong going to the mall. But what I'm saying is that look at all the advertisement. And even at the mall, you see all of this buying and trading and selling, which the message is just blaring. Subconsciously is saying this: unless you have this thing, unless you purchase this thing, unless you obtain this thing, you're not going to be happy. And what we really need to do is step back and really be thankful and grateful for what God has given us. Because I've always said, ever since I've been a Christian, that hey, one of the things that really shows a real smallness in a person's character is an ungrateful spirit, an ungrateful heart, when they do not show appreciation and thanks and consideration. That really shows the smallness of a person's character. And you certainly can see it in this guy. Anybody have anyone to add or share?